Campus FM i presenta Musicisti Zaza Maltin Harsa len il hidma ul carriera ta Zaza fil asam tan musica Kidba produzioni o presentazioni ta Joyce Gullheimer
Nisser mekom nisti rinkom għal program juħov dina sensira. Il-mistiedna li għandi l-lum isima ta' fosgu Rebecca Hall, Rebecca Hall Farrugia, jo Rebecca Farrugia Hall. Imma il-kelma Zaza, essaċ, mish ġdida għall-udjenza Maltija, dawk li jsegwu d-dinja muzikali li Rebecca jafu għazgur, jafu l-ħila tagħha meta hija jduq il-flaut. Anki l-pikkolo, imma l-iktar il-flaut. Imma jiena ma stajċ nitlef dina l-opportunità li nistidina f'dina sensiela għax Rebecca hija waħda mill-mainstays tal-orkestra tagħna, inqisha jiena waħda minn għalaħax ma jkunx hemm miegħu xi tnejn oħra għalija għaliex jagħtu ċertu timbru lill-orkestra u ma kontx daħalta f'sensieli oħrajn u f'din is-sensiela ma stajċ inħallija barra għada kif daħlet lura mill-ix wies għax għamlet żmien kompli tistudja għal PhD. Il-PhD aħna qegħdin nirrekordjaw fl-aħħar jum ta' frar il-bieraħ fil-għaxija kellha wkoll part commitment biex ngħidlu hekk tal-PhD ridettati recital fil-kunċert għax ma kienitx waħedha f'St. James Cavalier fil-Music Room. U il-PhD nistgħu ngħidu li qiegħed ġobuta għalkemm għadha mhix daqshekk uffiċjali, imma il-PhD hija ġobuta. U llum nixtieq nlaqgħakom ma' Rebecca. Rebecca Hall kulħadd jafha bħala Rebecca Hall. Jiena introduċejta bħala Rebecca Farrugia Hall jew Hall Farrugia. Ħadd tgħidilna hi għaliex għażlet li fil-Facebook tidher bħala Rebecca Farrugia Hall. Well, first of all, welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you, Joyce. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. I'm going to conduct this interview in English, although you have been in Malta for a long time, and I know that you can speak Maltese fluently, but I suppose you feel more at ease if we conduct the interview in English.
Mela milbidunet, most of my Maltese has been learned at work. And there are some
So I can imagine what
is that? Malo l-klim hazin in Badlora. So probably if you don't want to be pressing the beep button for most of the interview, I think it's probably safer if we do it in English.
Right. We'll do it in English.
Thank you.
As I said, you are known as Rebecca Hall, but on Facebook you are Rebecca Hall Farrugia or Rebecca Farrugia Hall?
Rebecca Farrugia Hall on
and
Facebook.
Why?
Well, a couple of reasons. First, because I'm an incredibly analog person, so anything that has to do with technology really frightens me terribly. And I'm also a very private person in many ways, so I don't like the idea of somebody being able to type up my name and everything about my life comes up. So I have the privacy settings on Facebook are, you know, something that the FBI would have difficulty cracking if they wanted to try to find me. And also, just as another reason, there's a very famous British actress named Rebecca Hall, and I don't want her to think that she can usurp my position on Facebook. So
you are not
I put in
British.
The Farrugia for my husband's last
and
name.
And you are, of course, married to a Farrugia who is a Maltese.
I certainly am.
And you have two kids? You
have two
children?
Two gorgeous children. Benjamin will be 11 on the 20th of April, and Sophia Catherine will be 5 on the 16th of June.
Already 5.
Tempus fugit,
Tempus
Joyce.
Fugit,
I know. I still haven't got my figure back.
No, you have it. You have it back. So, you are not British. You are
no,
Canadian.
I'm Canadian. I come from Newfoundland, which is the island province on the very east coast. Its landmass is about the size of France, but the population is only the size of Malta. So, many people ask me when I come, how did you transition
how
from
How did
Canada?
You manage to live in this claustrophobic atmosphere that there is in Malta, because you said the population is the same as the one in Malta, but the landmass is the size of France, so there's plenty of room.
But you know, Joyce, one thing that I discovered very shortly after coming here is that island people are the same wherever they come from. Incredibly proud, patriotic, I think, competitive, because in an island, no matter what the size of it, there are usually limited resources and you have to fend for yourself. Very friendly, outgoing people most of the time, but suspicious of strangers. To give you an example, in Newfoundland, and it's pronounced that way even though it's spelled Newfoundland.
But it is pronounced Newfoundland.
Newfoundland.
I remember that from school.
Newfoundland, exactly. To give you an example of that, in Newfoundland, we Newfoundlanders would refer to people who come from other parts of Canada as CFAs, or come from aways. Newfoundland as a province... Come from aways, CFAs. So Newfoundland was only a part of Canada as of 1949. It was the first British colony, and it was actually claimed by Sir Walter Raleigh in 1565, but it was discovered by John Cabot in 1497. So you're looking at a long history as part of the British Empire, as an independent dominion. Mm-hmm. And so there's still a very strong nationalist feeling, very much similar to what you have in Malta as well. And a strong religious tradition as well there, split pretty evenly between Catholics and Protestants, Irish Catholics and English Protestants who would have come over. But the similarities really are very similar. So with the exception of the heat, which I never quite get used to, and the dampness in February, which I never quite get used to, the transition hasn't been that difficult for me.
Good.
Having a gorgeous husband, of course,
has not
been a hindrance either.
Of course not. And you have settled down quite well.
Well, it's been 15 years.
It's been 15
Joyce,
years.
I'm almost here, almost half my life now. So quasi Maltia, quasi Canadisa. Nofs un nofs.
Nofs un nofs. Nofs Maltia, nofs Canadisa. How did it all start?
Oh.
Your music career.
Oh, music. I thought you were going to ask about the husband.
No.
That comes
your
later.
Music career.
Well, it's anecdotal more than anything. I think I've always been a person who's been very comfortable on stage, whatever format that is. And but really, I wanted to start out as a singer. And my older sister is a Baroque opera specialist, and she's sung, you know, all of the major concert halls for that, and she's recorded for Deutsche Grammophon and all these sorts of things.
So you come from a musical family?
I would say probably a naturally musical family, but not something which is a tradition. You know, I didn't have a father who was an opera singer and a grandmother who was a composer or something like that. It was something that we started at home. And I wanted to be an opera singer. I had the most glorious vocal teacher when I was a young girl and desperately wanted to do that. But I was tiny, absolutely like a sprite. You wouldn't imagine it
now.
I'm 6 feet tall. But I was such a tiny slip of a girl that my vocal teacher wanted me to start to play a wind instrument so that I could develop my lung capacity in order to be able to sing better.
That's how it all started.
And so the flute came along, and it was either that or the French horn, but I remember the first bandmaster looking at me and saying, "You're too small to play the French horn, you might as well play the flute." He had no idea, of course, that I was going to turn into Hippolyta, Queen of the Amazons, but such as it is.
So you started the flute.
Yeah.
You started learning
to play the flute. Voice, piano, I did ballet, although I'm not particularly graceful, and I'd probably kill any leading man that would try to pick me up now. We had a lot of things that went on in the family, but as the years went on, you know, you start to decide on something that's more your specialty. And so I love to sing, much to the consternation of my colleagues, and especially to poor Maestro Laus, who's up there trying to conduct two sopranos in a Mozart aria, one of them who's supposed to be playing the flute and the other one who's actually singing. So it causes some grief for my colleagues, but it's very hard for them to shut me up, so they just let me go on my way.
But it seems to me as if it wasn't you who chose the flute. Am I mistaken?
I think we kind of fell
into
each other.
Are you happy with having the flute now as your first instrument?
You know, it's a funny thing. A lot of people say, if I had my time back, what would I play?
Mm-hmm.
I have a secret hunking to play viola, actually. I love the idea of being inside of a section and working with others in that way. But really, people tell me that, in terms of personality, I think more than anything else, that I'm not an ensemble player as much as I am a leading player. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, I suppose the flute has a lot of solos that are very prominent, and it also is an instrument which can help to lead in a mm-hmm. section. It also helps, for instance, we play a wonderful woodwind quintet, and I can do a little bit of conducting with the end of the instrument. So I will never be the next Zubin Mehta, but I can manage to pull us through some tricky passages sometimes. But yeah, I would probably not realistically choose anything else. It's also the easiest to carry, and it's very pretty.
It is. And it's very feminine as well.
But you know, surprisingly, it's actually not. I've heard the most astounding traditional Irish flute players, and they're almost universally male. And if you think, for instance, of James Galway. Or Ron Paul or mm-hmm. Alain Marion or Peter Lucas Graf, who's one of my mentors from Switzerland, they're all fantastic male flute players. It's only been in the last maybe 40 years that the flute has become a female instrument. You have to remember that in the Victorian period, especially,
Does it have anything to do with breath control?
No, I don't think so necessarily, but I think probably...
Or the amount of breathing?
I think it has much more to do with sound quality and mm-hmm. a kind of mental perception of things. We have this kind of mentality, especially since like about 1940s, 1950s in America, that men are really big and butch, and if they're going to play things, they're going to play trumpets and mm-hmm. tubas and trombones mm-hmm. and electric guitars.
And you find
stuff.
That is not true at all, or else it doesn't follow. Always.
I don't think it makes really much difference. I have a great friend of mine who plays in Copenhagen, fantastic piccolo player, a big guy. And, you know, he's very, very male. He does archery. He has a daughter and all this sort of stuff. But he just happens to be a crackerjack piccolo player. Mm-hmm. And, I don't really think that gender has so much to do with it.
So it's more a projection.
I really do think that the instrument finds you in a strange way. And if you're a 6 foot, 100 kilo man who wants to play the piccolo, my darling, you go for it. And if you're a little teeny tiny girl, as I had a friend in grad school with who can play the tuba better than anybody I know, with the exception of Paul Borge, of course, then, you know, perfect. It found mm-hmm. the tuba found her, the piccolo found him, and long may they live happily ever after.
So if a young man who's over 6 feet tall mm-hmm. were to come and ask for your approval or advice mm-hmm. on whether to play the piccolo or not, mm-hmm. or whether to choose another instrument, your answer would depend on his psychological makeup.
Oh, sure. I mean, you
not
have to...
Not on his physical strength.
No. Well, I mean, of course, if he's very attractive, then I'll be very happy to take him for lessons. No, I'm joking. No, really, it has to do you love it? That's the question. Are you prepared to commit the time and the energy that it takes to be good at it? And are you prepared to put up with the inevitable frustrations? Thankfully, with the flute, there are slightly less grief issues than you have with things like oboes or bassoons, where you constantly have to make your reeds and you're dependent on humidity and little pieces of cane and sharpness of knives. I mean, flutes are a whole lot more expensive.
You don't have to have
You don't
a reed.
Have that grief.
No.
No, we have no reeds.
You have no reeds.
It's the joy of my life.
I was going to ask you if you are thankful for it.
I am thankful every day of my life when I sit next to my glorious, talented, and long-suffering colleagues in the orchestra who are all sitting there with these very sharp knives, scraping away at these tiny little bits of reed and becoming so frustrated with water and damp and cold and wind. Flutes are a whole lot more expensive, but boy, are they low maintenance compared to the oboes and the bassoons.
They make for a simpler life. And you get the same satisfaction.
Well, they make for a simpler life until you have to go to the bank manager. And then they make things slightly more complicated. But yes, generally, once you have it, life is a little bit easier.
Right. Let's go back to we know that you started studying music in Canada. Mm-hmm. What brought you to Malta?
Love,
you must
my
have started
darling,
your career in Canada, no?
Yes, I did.
As a flutist.
Yes, as a reluctant flute player, I started my career in Malta. I did my undergraduate studies at Memorial University mm-hmm. of Newfoundland, which is the largest music school in Atlantic Canada. Then I went right after my undergrad, I went to do my master's at the University of Western Ontario, which is I think, the third biggest music school in Canada, and I did my master's studies there. Then after I finished with the studies, I worked for just about a year doing freelance with Orchestra London Canada, which is one of the big regional orchestras, and also doing administrative work with that same orchestra. So that was very interesting and insightful for future reference, I think probably is the best way to put that. But really what brought me here was love. My sister, my older sister, Meredith, whom I mentioned before, is married to a fellow of Maltese descent. So they came to Malta for their honeymoon.
So you had heard of Malta before you arrived?
Yes, of course. Well, I'm also a history, a real history buff. I'm a real nerd like that. So I knew a fair bit of my European history. And, of course, Malta is a small but important part of that. And so when they came here for their honeymoon, they were met by the typical Maltese 50 people at the airport greeting committee.
The family?
And, yes, of course. And one of them was my future husband. So after the holiday was over, they invited him to come to Canada, and he did, and the rest is history. That
so
was 1993.
You met your husband.
I did. I met him
it
in the days
your
before.
Sister.
It was. One marriage brings another is the expression. It was the days before internet and the days before voice over internet protocol and Skype and all these sorts of things. So we had a very old fashioned courtship, hundreds and hundreds of letters, and I still have them. And they're still gorgeous, all wrapped up in ribbon at home.
Are you the romantic type? Sentimental type?
Desperately, passionately romantic. And so much so that I get a bit of a hard time at the orchestra, especially from Maestro Laus, who always accuses me of playing everything in too romantic a style and that I should be a little more detached. This is most of the time with things like CPE Bach, and I always fight with him, and I tell him, I'm not playing a Baroque flute, and you're not conducting a Baroque orchestra, and I'm going to play with everything in my heart.
So who's your favorite composer?
Oh, my gosh. I think it depends
flute,
on the day.
Of course, for flute.
No, I don't have a favorite composer for flute. I know who I don't like. I don't know what I don't like to play, but
you don't like what?
I don't like cheesy, sentimental, over-the-top, saccharine kind of things. And I also don't like virtuosity just for the sake
for
of
the
showing
sake of
off. No, it has to have integrity. And so, like, for instance, this last night I did a concert which was Bach and Bach-inspired composers. So for 2 months, I've been eating, sleeping, breathing, thinking about Bach.
And not so, with him.
Not sleeping with Bach, no. But he's always been in the back of my mind. Not all the time, but most of the time. And so up to yesterday, I was passionately in love with Bach. Today, I could care less if I hear any more Bach for the next month. I absolutely, passionately adore anything that has real integrity to it. So, for instance, one of the pieces on the program last night was by a composer that anybody who's not a flutist probably wouldn't have heard of, and his name is Siegfried Karg Ehlert, and in 1917 he composed the piece that I played last night.
Just quite new.
Well, 103 years old, so I suppose in the great scope of things, compared to Bach, it's new, but it's a solo flute piece and very, very passionate. It's actually called the Appassionata, and that requires great concentration and stamina, but also an ability to just completely let go and sing. Anything that I can sing and play, I guess that's my real passion.
So let's start hearing you play the flute.
Okay.
We've been talking about the flute.
Yeah.
We've been talking about your career. Now we put them together and we hear you play the flute.
Okay.
What have you prepared for us?
The first piece that we're going to play is one that has a real emotional connection for me. It's the Adagio, the second movement from the Fifth Brandenburg Concerto, and this is with Nadia De Bono, who's the fantastic sub-leader
of the orchestra,
and Maestro Laus is playing harpsichord, and this is for the launch of the new harpsichord, which was bought with the great assistance of the BOV, no plug intended, sorry, in January 2009, and this was quite an emotional time for me at the orchestra, and it was a very emotional performance. So
was it your return to the orchestra?
No, it was just as I was beginning to move towards leaving the orchestra, and it was very hard for me. So I often hear this, and I well up a little bit. So anyway, this is it's beautiful playing, and Nadia and Maestro Laus are extraordinary, and it was an honor to play it with the two of them.
And it is by
Bach.
By Bach.
Of course.
So let's hear this music that Rebecca will play for us now on the flute.
Thank you.
So that was Bach. And I'm sure that our listeners enjoyed listening to it.
I hope so. I enjoyed playing it.
You enjoyed playing it. When you met your husband, had you any idea that you were getting married? Of course you knew, but that you would be starting, that you would be continuing your career here in Malta.
Well,
permanently.
Well, that's also an interesting story because in my husband's profession, he would have had to retrain for
three years.
He's an accountant by trade, although he does various other things, some diplomacy, some legal work. So he's a kind of jack of all trades when it comes to
to money business.
Yes. Well, yes. and so he would have required having to retrain. And so what we decided to do was, you know, music being a universal language, we knew that there was an orchestra here and that there, you know, could possibly be some opportunity. I would have followed him very happily to Rwanda, you know,
to
given the opportunity.
The world, as long as
anywhere, so long as I was with him. And, of course, I feel absolutely the same way today. But we had very little feedback because at that time, first of all, there were very few foreigners in Malta. This was in 1994. Five. Mm-hmm. And so we wrote letters to everyone that we could think of, and we had no responses from anyone, and it was just heartbreaking. So my husband came to visit me in August of 95, and you know, we went out for dinner, and we broke off the engagement. And we said, you know, it's just not possible.
It's
breaking our hearts, and, you know, let's just finish this holiday, and then, you know, we'll part as friends, and that will be it. And the next day, in the post, there was a small letter. It was, I can see it in front of me now, from Maestro Laus, asking if I would agree to come over and do a trial run of Charles Camilleri's Maltese Cross. And every year at Christmas time, I send Maestro Laus a Christmas card, and he must be sick of getting Christmas cards from me for now 15 years, because I think I sent the first one from Canada, just thanking him, because I have... Really, if it wasn't for his faith in me, John Lowell's faith in me, he was the chair of the Manuel Theatre Board at that time, and Charles and Dion Buhajar and others who really fought to bring this feisty, female, foreign flute player over, then I wouldn't have the glorious family that I have. So I have this kind of bodyguard of guardian angels, John Lowell and Michael Laus and Dion and Charles, bless his soul.
You have a special saint you pray to?
No, I don't, because I'm not a particularly religious person. Sorry if I'm scandalizing anyone, but... I don't, but, you know, I'm generally quite a spiritual person, so prayer for me is something which is kind of intimate and personal.
Very personal.
Yeah, so I don't believe in, you know, standing in front of an icon or that kind of stuff. It's not my belief process, but I sure do think sometimes that there are people who are looking out for you. My husband's father passed away last year after a very, very short illness, and my daughter Sophia has the most marvelous way of summing it up. She says, "Nannu is a star, and he's twinkling down on me." And, you know, sometimes I think that's, you know, important for us too. You know, not just looking at a picture of a saint or
so
how many times you say the rosary.
Your father-in-law.
Yes.
Looking after you.
Well, I hope he is. I hope he's not. He's not repeating that Maltese village, Maltese expression of a good cow is sold in her own village. I did give him two grandchildren after all, so I hope he's happy with me.
No, he must be very happy with you. And your career went, as they say in Italian, a gonfie vele. You came for the Maltese Cross, but you stayed.
I actually didn't stay because there was a fantastic Maltese flute player here named Laura Falzon working with the orchestra, and she was actually under contract at the time. And
Laura is abroad, no?
Yes. Laura's lived abroad for years. She lives in New York and she's doing fantastically. But she was here and no one knew whether or not she was going to have the patience to stay or go. And so I actually went back to Canada after the Maltese Cross and remembered calling Maestro Laus again. It was January of 96, and he told me, "I don't know what's happening. Laura is here, and she doesn't seem to wish to go, and we don't know what's going on, so you're not going to have the position anytime soon." And this was again two or three days before my husband's birthday, my future husband's birthday. So again, I called him, and just before his birthday, we broke off the engagement again. And 2 days later, there There was a fax from Tony Kasodarian saying, "Come, you start next month." So I remember at that
time.
So
by the time Laura had decided.
Just within those days. And I went down to fax off the approval, because at that time there wasn't even email. And I walked in downtown St. John's, Newfoundland in February in the snow, slipped on the ice, fell and broke my elbow 4 weeks before I was supposed to start here. And I thought, you know, if there was ever anybody telling me you have to go through so many trials and tribulations to get through this, I wouldn't have believed it possible. But I did the last physiotherapy the day that I got on the plane, and I played for 4 weeks with tensor bandages around my elbow, and nobody knew the difference.
Good.
So, determination, my darling.
So, looking back in hindsight,
yeah,
how would you say, how would you describe your first years in Malta? Were they difficult?
Oh, boy,
how did you
Joyce,
mix with your friends, with the other members of the orchestra? Did you make friends easily? Was it difficult for you to integrate?
That is a loaded question. So I'm going to call on all my diplomatic resources and answer it as best I can. There are certain people that you click with immediately, and you just know that you have a great and deep musical affinity for them. And then there are other people that you work with day in and day out, and you may say hello to them in the morning, but you hardly know them. So I was incredibly fortunate, because there was also a very green young oboe player who had just started a few months before me and was my darling, dear, almost like a brother, closer than my own brother,
yes, John McDonough.
And so we've had thick and thin together. And also at that time there was Donato Mattei, who was just a glorious harpist from Milan, and the three of us clicked really well. But in the early years, I think I wanted to spend as much time as I could, obviously, with my husband, and so socializing with other members of the orchestra was not as it is now. And there was also, I hate to say it if I'm offending anybody, but you'll probably remember the dark days where the foreigners were not as appreciated, maybe, or as welcomed as they are now, and especially one who is usually not afraid to speak their mind. Which
the
is
orchestra
me.
Is much bigger now than it used to be.
The orchestra is bigger,
and
it's
there are many people from abroad.
Yeah, but
mainly
also
from Eastern countries.
Yeah, but
do you find it easy?
Again, the orchestra is quite socially broken up into different groups. So we have
the Maltese group and the foreigners.
No, not necessarily, because there are mixed marriages, we can say. So there's a couple of us who are foreign with Maltese partners, and then there are people who are foreign but get on very well with the Maltese players. Then there are some Maltese players who, are happy with themselves or have complete social lives outside. And then there is a large group of Eastern European musicians, and we lovingly refer to them as the Eastern Bloc. So, and understandably, obviously, for linguistic reasons as well as cultural reasons, they usually hang out quite a bit together. But the orchestra is still very young in many ways. It's much younger in terms of age, I think, mean average age, than it was when I first got here. So I think probably I'm one of the old folks now.
And the repertory has changed, too.
Repertory has changed, but not as much as you might think, although things are getting more progressive. You have to...
Is it possible, with the complement of musicians that are on the orchestra, to introduce newer works?
Sure it is. We just did a concert, last week, of all works by young composers. So that was terrific, and there were two young Maltese conductors. Doing that, Andre Huber and Michelle Cacchia-Castelletti, and they both did a terrific job, and it was a joy to see their joy. Whenever you have a conductor who comes in front of you and brings energy, even if it's in a very quiet way, and a total commitment, it's a joy to play for that person.
What happens if you don't like the conductor?
Oh boy, Joyce. Well, let's see.
What if you like the conductor? Because that would make life very easy, no?
No, it doesn't always make it. It doesn't always make it easy, because you can have a conductor that you like who doesn't really conduct very well. So that can be a problem.
Yes.
I think you have to have a
certain... I'm talking about a conductor who knows how to conduct.
Yeah. Well, it's a tough one. I think in terms of a conductor, at least for me personally, I have to have a number of things. First, I have to have a deep respect for their musical knowledge and understanding. I don't necessarily need to like them as a person. I may not know them as a person. For instance, we had a conductor earlier this year, Maestro Burfin, who mm-hmm. conducted Schumann. And Schumann is not one of my favorite composers, but he made me like it by the end, you know. So, first of all, a formidable intellect. They must possess that, and a great commitment to the music. They also have to lead you. It could be in a flamboyant kind of matte hair flapping way like Brian Schembri, or it could be in a very quiet, introspective but profound way without any bravura like Maestro Laus. I mean, complete polar opposites in terms of conductors. But for both of them, I will play with all of my heart. Probably
but
more
you
for
like
Michael.
Them. Yeah, what happens if you don't like the conductor?
Well, then you shift into your professional mode. Mm-hmm. And whether or not you like the conductor, you're playing what's in front of you. If you don't like the conductor and you don't like the music, that's when you really have a problem. Because then you have to go simply based on your own professionalism.
Has it ever happened to you?
Where
you just played the note without really interpreting the music?
No. Has it ever happened that I didn't like a conductor? Yes. Has it ever happened that I cannot play the music? No. But there are some conductors that I will play more readily for, and some conductors that touch my heart, and I can just have one tiny look or a glimpse from them, and that's enough for me to just, you know, want to sing
of
my heart out.
Of course, it's always better when you have a good rapport with whoever is playing with you or whoever is conducting you, no?
Yeah, sure. But, I mean, your rapport doesn't necessarily need to be a personal one.
No,
it can be a musical one.
Course,
if you have an understanding, you can love the person that's up there in front of you, but if they don't know how to wave the stick or they don't know how to get something from the orchestra, you feel like you're playing against a wall. Mm-hmm. And that's a frustrating feeling. It's hard. It's work then. When it's a great conductor or a conductor that you love and who is within your spectrum of musical understanding and comprehension, then it's a joy. And sometimes, as an example, we did a concert at the beginning of December, and I was particularly partial to this one because it was the Nielsen Flute Concerto mm-hmm. and also Sibelius Symphony. And
this is a marvelous piece of work.
Oh, my gosh. It was a joy to play. I mean, really long and, for me, really tiring because I had played the Nielsen and
yes,
then I had
course.
To sit into the orchestra to play the
Sibelius.
No, but the Nielsen was fantastic. But when you have a great rapport with the conductor, and for me, that particular concert was an absolute revelation because Michael Laus has a reputation, God love his heart, sorry Michael, for being into himself. And
very introspective.
Yes, but he's not.
He's not.
And when I worked on the Nielsen with him, he rose to the challenge of that in such an extraordinary way. And all of the musicians felt it in that piece and in the Sibelius that followed. And we soared through
In fact,
it.
I told his father that I really love to see Michael enjoying himself and loving the music because
yeah.
people have this idea about him, this characterization of
yeah,
Michael
but,
as being very introvert and very
yeah,
difficult
but,
to penetrate. Mm-hmm. But he loves music. He loves
well,
music.
It's not just that he loves it. I mean, he has an extraordinary mind
yes.
for it, but also an extraordinary heart for it. And the thing that I love, I mean, lately, and I suppose it's been in maybe in the last couple of years, maybe he's having some sort of midlife crisis and he's dead. Sorry.
I'm not positive.
No. But he's relaxing. He's relaxing more.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he conducts, the New Year's concert was a joy. The mm-hmm. Sibelius concert was a joy. Mm-hmm. But when he plays, that's when you can actually hear who he is.
But this is your program about you.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So let's listen to more music.
Okay,
what
sure.
have you prepared for us?
The next pieces are the songs of Bilitis. There are two of those from the music of Debussy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is from a recital that I did with the amazing Sophia Rahman, who's mm-hmm. a British pianist.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first recital of the DMA. And this
right.
was in April of last year.
Thank you.
So that was Debussy.
Fantastic pieces.
Fantastic pieces. The Impressionists. Do you like the Impressionists?
I like everything, Joyce. I mean, so long as it's something that
has
integrity.
But you choose.
I wouldn't choose it. I try to put together programs which either have a theme, like that program was entitled Siren Song, and it was all music which was based on mythology, but also on love and unrequited love. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting program to put together. So the first piece was the story of Syrinx, also by Debussy. Then there were the six Bilitis songs. Then there was a very heavy German romantic sonata based on the Undine legend by Karl Reinecke. And then a very terrifying piece by Jolivet, French 20th century composer, called Chantelinos. Which was basically a threnody, the cries and laments of one who has been lost through death.
Mentioning Jolivet and 20th century music, what do you think about 20th century music?
Well, now I think we have to say, what do we think about 21st century music?
Yes, of course. But in Malta, we are still trying to put across 20th century music.
Yeah, it's true. And I think that audiences are maybe becoming a little more aware. Maybe. I look for an example at the production of Soldier's Tale that was done. Now, Soldier's Tale is a piece which is 102 years old, but the reaction to it, obviously it was done in an extraordinary way, but it was electrifying. I went to see it twice, and I know that it was full of teenage school children.
It was meant for
school
children.
They loved it. Yeah, but it was, you know, electrifying for them, too. And I think by doing things that are new, very new, and even not so new, or new to Malta.
But new to Malta.
Yeah, we broaden people's ears a little bit. The Nielsen Concerto that we'll hear in a little bit later was written, I think, in 1925, but it was the first time that it was played here.
That it was played here in Malta.
Yeah, and for many people, including some critics, it was they didn't understand it. And that was strange to me because it was something which is very self-explanatory as a piece and very clearly laid out. But when you don't have that language, that frame of reference in your ears, it takes a little while to figure.
You know what I think? I think that it takes a lot of time for audiences to be educated as much as the musicians.
It does.
And
but
critics too.
Yeah, maybe too. But there's a way around that, of course, and that is making music and making performances more accessible. And that's something that, for me, has been really important in the 15 years that I've been here. I remember the first concerts that I did, even in the Salzwert, I think I'd only been here a couple of months, and when I stood up to introduce the pieces and actually speak about the pieces, there was a kind of, oh, what's she doing? musicians don't speak, they only play. And of course now many people are starting to do that, but I find that it gives you a great communication tool with mm-hmm. the audience. It allows them to understand things in a non-threatening way. And that's very important to help them open their ears. And when their ears are open, they might go home and say, gee, I really like that piece by Carl Nielsen or John Cage or Boulez. Let's go and see if there's anything else that they mm-hmm. can find. And, you know, if you touch one or two people like that, you know, you've converted somebody, and that's not a bad thing. I'm a huge advocate of new music, and part of the DMA is actually a brand new concerto as well, which is being written for me at the moment, and that will be exciting. The composer is the man who's the subject of my DMA paper. His name is Jack Behrens. He's a really well-known Canadian composer, and he's written a number of works for me in the past, and since I came over here, we've stayed in contact and in closer contact over this last year. So the final DMA recital will have a piece of his on it that he wrote for me a number of years ago, and then there will also be the concerto as part of that. Part of the DMA process.
And when will the DMA be?
Oh, gosh. Well, I've got two more performances for the DMA still. Yes. That will be one of them in June.
Coming June?
Yeah, end of May, beginning of June, which will be the more Bach, actually, the B minor orchestral suite, the second orchestral suite with Maestro Laus and the MPO.
Did you choose the repertoire yourself? Or was it chosen for you?
Well, I choose my own repertoire, but in this particular case, it had been something that Maestro Laus and I had been discussing for a while, but we hadn't had an opportunity to present it because I've been, for the last 4 years, I've been away from the orchestra for the last 2 out of 4 years. So
since you've been back, you've been very, very busy.
Yeah, well, it's like either people figure that they better take advantage of me in case I go again, or they're happy to have me back, or they have some other scary ulterior motive. I don't know what it is,
but don't know
it's been very busy. I mean, we've had 4 big recitals in the last year, which has been that Siren Song one where the Debussy came from mm-hmm. in April, a huge Cosmos Wind Quintet concert with the fantastic John McDonough and Godfrey Mifsud, Ulrika mm-hmm. Bullman, and Jose Gutierrez. That was in May. Mm-hmm. Then there's been a lot of orchestral stuff, and there was the Nielsen in December. And then this one with Joanne Camilleri and Ulrika Bullman of all Bach and Bach-inspired composers last night. There's also been 2 Rodrigo Fantasias and another Rodrigo Fantasia Par in Gentil Ombre next week. There's some recordings at the end of March. There's Lucia de Lammermoor and the enormous flute cadenzas in that one in the middle of March. And then there's probably another Cosmos concert in May. There's the Bach at the end of May. There's more recordings in May. There's a concert with strings at the beginning of June.
A very full...
And a partridge in a pear tree.
Yeah, a very full program.
Yes.
What about teaching? We haven't touched on teaching at all. Would you like to teach? Or do you teach?
I love working with musicians, and it doesn't matter if it's a beginning student or if it's somebody who's really advanced, but it has to be someone who's prepared to commit as much energy as I am. And so I would never consider to take a student on a financial side of things, because really, this is going to sound silly, but money is never a first priority for me. The first priority is finding someone with whom I can work, who has an understanding, who has a love for the instrument, and a determination to do well. And if that person is a grade one student, or if they're a PhD student, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Good. We've learned a few things about you which we didn't know.
Well, I'm not that much of a mystery, but...
but, of course, you go to the theatre, you play your piece, we say a few words afterwards, but we are not really in touch. We don't know each other that well. And I'm sure that the audience must have loved listening to you talking about your life, talking about your present, talking about your past, and also your future.
Well, I hope that I'm slightly less of a mystery than I was, although I will always reserve a few cards very close to the chest.
It's been a pleasure. Let me tell you, it's been
Joyce,
a pleasure.
Very
now,
much.
And we end this program, because it's time for us to end it now, by the Nielsen Concerto.
This was one of the
which
most special nights.
Which you loved so much.
I loved every single second of it. I played with all my heart, and this is the Nielsen.
Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thank you, Joyce. A pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.